This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
When it comes to explaining global politics and world events, few faces are more familiar than Fareed Zakarias.
This is GPS, the Global Public Square. Welcome to all of you in the United States and around the world. I'm Fareed Zakarias, coming to you from New York.
Meanwhile, in Gaza, the humanitarian situation worsens by the day, with the UN warning that famine in the north is imminent.
Looking at the crises proliferating around the world, it's clear that we are in an age of geopolitical tension that resembles the Cold War, a time of constant, continual threats to international order. But this time, the West is treating each of these threats as one-offs to be dealt with separately in the hope that normalcy will return. But conflict is the new normal. Look around.
Fareed Zakarias hosts the CNN International Affairs show GPS, the Global Public Square. It debuted in 2008. He's also a best-selling author and columnist for The Washington Post, and now he's gathered his insights about world events into a new book called Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present. It's out this week. He highlights revolutions of the past to try to help us understand the moment we're living in. We'll get into all that and more after the break. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Stay with us.
This message comes from Capital One, presenting sponsor of the 2024 Tiny Desk Contest. Earlier this year, unsigned musicians from around the country submitted their original songs for the 10th annual Tiny Desk Contest. The panel of judges are hard at work picking standout entries, and you can follow along and choose your favorite videos as well. The winner gets to play their very own Tiny Desk concert, then headline a tour with NPR Music this summer. Want to come along for the ride? Visit tinydeskcontest.npr.org to learn more, then check out the Venture X card from presenting sponsor Capital One. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Fareed Zakarias joins us now from NPR in New York. Fareed, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fareed, you write that we're at the nexus of seismic revolutions in four areas: economics, technology, identity, and geopolitics. What's your argument for what makes this moment particularly revolutionary?
It's really the scale of change and the speed of change. So if you look at, for example, the expansion of globalization. So, you know, we've been globalizing for forever, but it's been a fairly slow, steady pace. So if you think about the 1950s, the countries that sort of joined the global economy, the open trading system, were Japan in the 1950s, and then Korea in the 1960s, and then maybe Singapore and Hong Kong and small countries like that along the way. And then sometime about the mid-1980s or the late 1980s, you have this seismic shift where China comes online, India comes online, Latin American countries come online, all of Eastern Europe after the fall of the Soviet Union comes online. So in other words, all these countries that had been sheltered behind protectionist walls now are all part of the single global economy. Look at information technology, where we've had this explosion of technological innovation, where we've really created a whole new economy, a digital economy that didn't exist. You know, every one of the largest companies in the world today is a technology company that didn't exist 25 years ago, with, I think, the two exceptions of Microsoft and Apple. And they're, you know, 35 years old, no more than that. If you look at identity, you know, for most of human history, women were second-class citizens, tens of thousands of years. And in the last 30 or 40 years, all that has changed. And it's all happening at the same time. Some of these processes in the past, like the Industrial Revolution, took 150 years. The Digital Revolution has taken 20. So that's my argument, that we're going through more change at the same time than we've ever seen before, and it's producing a backlash.
Age of Revolutions highlights a few revolutions of the past, what you call the first liberal revolution in the Netherlands from the late 16th century through most of the 1600s, the Glorious Revolution in England in the late part of the 17th century, the French Revolution in 1787, and then the Industrial Revolutions in the U.S. and Britain from about 1760 to 1840. There are hundreds of past revolutions you could have written about. Why did you decide to highlight the ones you did?
I was trying to figure out what is the most distinctive thing that has happened in human history over the last 400 or 500 years. And it is the creation of liberal democratic societies that have prospered economically. If you look at a graph of the income of an average person through the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, it's basically a flat line, no increase in income until about the 17th century. And then it just shoots up. And why does that happen? It happens because of the creation of these more liberal, more democratic, more market-oriented societies, starting with, as you say, the Netherlands, then Britain, then the United States, all of Western Europe, and now much of the world. And so I chose those revolutions that explain this great shift in history. You know, so it's really the most consequential revolutions that have pushed us forward and the backlash to those revolutions. And you're absolutely right. There are hundreds of revolutions one could have talked about. But, you know, my mentor when I was getting my PhD once said to me, he was explaining something and I said, well, but isn't it a little more complicated than that? And he said to me, Fareed, everybody knows the world is complicated. Our job is to clarify without simplifying as scholars. And I've always taken that to heart, you know, to try to clarify, you know, don't just give people a kind of an enormous plethora of detail. Give them some sense of clarity, but without making it too simplistic.
Hmm. Well, I want to go to this message we got from Scott in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'd really like to ask why he doesn't seem to ever address climate change in any of his talk about revolution, because that seems to me to be a very big destabilizing factor.
If I read, what's your response to Scott's message, and where do you think climate change fits into conversations around revolution today?
Well, it's a hugely consequential issue, and I do mention at the start of the book that I'm not going to deal with it just because, in a sense, it's the revolution that could overwhelm everything. You know, if it goes particularly badly, obviously it creates existential problems for humankind. But what I'm trying to explain is a particular dynamic, which is of economic and technological progress, how that changes our sense of who we are as the identity, and the backlash it creates. It's not that I don't think it's important. It's just that I'm sort of trying to explain a different thing. I'm not trying to write about every important thing in the world. I'm writing about the thing that I was focused on. And it's not because climate change isn't important, but I would have to say the truth of the matter is climate change has not so far changed our politics very much. In some ways, I wish it did, but it's not, you know, there is, people talk about how important climate change is, but whenever you ask them to pay a price for it, they resist. They, you know, there's a reason that we haven't had a gas tax hike in this country for 25 or 30 years. And it's not just us. In Europe, when Macron tried to do it, he got what is called the yellow vest protests in response. You're seeing it now with the much slower and lower adoption of electric vehicles than people expected. Hertz just returned half of its fleet of electric vehicles because people didn't want them. So there's a tension here where people claim to understand the importance of climate change, but the politics on the ground hasn't shifted very much.
Well, as you write about backlash, one of the things you discuss is the emergence of populist leaders in recent years. Let's hear from two of them.
They always say suburban housewives, they want something that's very important, security. They don't want illegal immigrants coming into our country. They don't want illegal immigrants knocking on their front door.
We had to build not just a physical wall on our borders, but a legal wall around our children to protect them from the gender ideology that targets them.
That was former president and current presumptive Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump speaking at a rally in Georgia just before the primary earlier this month. We also heard Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Dallas in 2022. So both Trump and Orban there have similar anti-immigrant and culture war rhetoric. So when you talk about backlash, contextualize that for us. What is it a backlash against?
Those are wonderful examples, and I'm so glad you juxtaposed them because that is exactly what I'm talking about. So in both cases, and in many others, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Erdogan in Turkey, these politicians basically, the argument they are making is you are living through all this rapid change and disruption. And notice they don't focus on economics. That is yesterday's subject. What they're talking about is the cultural change. Immigration is all about culture because it's really about, you know, when he talks about you don't want illegal immigrants knocking on your door, he's not talking about a Polish nanny. He's talking about somebody who is dark-skinned, who speaks Spanish, or somebody who, you know, is a Muslim immigrant from North Africa. In other words, people who look different, sound different, worship different gods, maybe. And so it's a kind of assault on your sense of your community. The argument about the children and all this, you know, new gender ideology is that you're going to, you know, you're trying to upend the traditional structure of family life. So it's all about a cultural reaction to change. And what people like Orban and Trump are saying is, we'll take you back to when it wasn't like that. We'll take you back to when America was great. You know, that's why the word again is so important in Trump's argument, in Trump's slogan. It's a return to an Edenic past.
Fareed, I'm curious to hear your perspective on why you think their ideologies gain traction, because immigration, for instance, it's always been part of the American story. There have always been LGBTQ people, and I want to focus on the U.S. right now. There's always been people who practice different religions in the U.S. So the idea that these are new developments is a rewriting of the historical record. So why do these ideologies gain traction?
I think one of the things it's a very good question, and I think that it's a complex one. So one thing that we often forget in America is that America has been the land of immigration and the land of immigrants, and has been welcomed people from all over the world. And this wonderful poem of Emma Lazarus on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses," is all true. But we also are a country that has very often been deeply suspicious, resentful, and hostile toward immigrants. The Know Nothing Party of the 19th century was founded in opposition to Irish and Italian immigration. Those were considered the, you know, the kind of dirty, smelly foreigners at the time. The Chinese Exclusion Act specifically targeted a group. And then, of course, in 1924, you had an actual, essentially a ban on any new immigration. You know, you locked in quotas from white Western European countries, keeping everybody else out until 1965 for 40 years. So there is a long history of anti-immigrant populism in America that Trump is in a way tapping into. And on the other front, look, of course, people like that, gay, lesbian, you know, obviously black, Hispanic people have all existed. But what is different is the identity revolution that has taken place in the last 20 or 30 years, where people are demanding that they be seen, they be heard, that they not have to conform to somebody else's conception of who they are, that they don't have to forget their own history. And that is a noisy and obstreperous and disruptive process, and it causes anxiety among people. And Trump is taking advantage of that anxiety and promising that he's going to, you know, get rid of all of that, take you back to some, I assume he means the 1950s. You know, that's his, you know, every one of these nostalgic moment, movements in politics often has some kind of, you know, conjured up, imagined past period when it was all better, which is almost always entirely, you know, a kind of a figment of their imagination. But I think that's what's going on here. It's the anxiety that change produces, and then demagogues like Trump and Orban and Bolsonaro take advantage of that anxiety.
In writing this book, I wonder what you came to understand about the facts of what happened during a time period and why it's called a revolution, but how in the sort of record of history, perhaps the details of what happened and why, how it may take on a different shape. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I thought a lot about that. And just one of the difficult decisions I had to make was to decide whether or not the American Revolution really counted as a revolution. And I came to the conclusion that it didn't, because fundamentally what the American Revolution was a change of government at the top. It was a war of independence. But that the underlying social structures in the United States stayed very similar. In many ways, the colonists were asking for what they described as the rights of Englishmen that had been usurped by George III. The social structure in the South, the deeply embedded slave structure, was kept entirely in place. And even in the North, there were efforts to, you know, kind of make the system more egalitarian and democratic, through things like the Whiskey Rebellion. And they were beaten back by there's a wonderful book called The Gentlemen Revolutionaries, and sort of trying to make that point that despite the fact of the revolution, these were all landed elites who wanted to keep the social structure just as it was. What did change America was the period from 1860 to 1880, if you will, essentially the Civil War and the industrialization that was happening around that time, because that totally upended the old social structure in the South, for at least for a while. The industrialization completely changed the nature of American elites, moving from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy, one which suddenly produced these new sources of wealth, the robber barons and all that kind of thing. That was much more profound change, and that was a real revolution in the terms I mean it, because that's when everything gets upended and and suddenly the politics get scrambled. And so in many of these cases, you know, you had to decide, well, how revolutionary really was this revolution?
We got this question from Brian in Virginia, who says, in the post-January 6th America that we live in today, what are your views, Fareed, on the willful blindness to historical facts and the problem of facts versus fear?
It's a real problem, this sort of post-truth environment where, you know, somebody can say essentially black is white and large numbers of people believe it. You know, I mean, I think this is in some ways the kind of central problem we face with holding somebody like Donald Trump to account for what he's done, is that he says that, you know, he has a completely different narrative based on a completely different set of made up facts, not facts, but, you know, facts in quotation marks. But here's the challenge. Millions and millions, tens of millions of Americans believe him and believe fervently in what he's saying. And so what exactly do you do? I mean, I've often thought that this is one of the reasons the media gets called so biased nowadays, because, you know, we try to point out these are lies, these are not truths, and then Trump attacks the media for pointing that out, and it seems like we're all anti-Trump, but we're not. We're just saying, you know, it is a lie that he won the 2020 election. And when he says that he did, he's lying. And there's no other way to put it if you're trying to speak plainly and truthfully. How to tackle the fact that 60 million Americans maybe agree with him? That's the challenge.
We're going to head to a quick break, but we'll be back with more of our conversation with Fareed Zakaria in just a moment. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial, a member FDIC.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
Let's get back to our conversation with Fareed Zakaria. You write in the book about how the terms left and right emerged, and I'd love for you to explain their origins and how they've perhaps shifted 250 years later.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story that I discovered while doing the research, and so I was so struck by it. So the two-sentence version of the French Revolution is the French king calls Parliament into session after 175 years because he wants to raise taxes. The Parliament says no, and that parliamentary resistance turns into a overthrow of the French monarchy, and that's the French Revolution. So when the French Parliament, was in those days called the Estates General, met for the first time in the late 18th century, it was organized, you sat basically according to your social rank. So the priestly class on one side, you know, the clergy, the aristocrats on the other side, the nobility, and then the commoners at the back. But very quickly, what starts to happen is people start sitting along with the people that they agree with, you know, in a kind of perfectly natural process of, you know, where we're hanging out with our compatriots. And the people who were pro the king, pro the monarchy, start hanging out on the right-hand side of the room. And the people who were against the monarchy start hanging out on the left-hand side of the room. Then this parliament moves to Paris from Versailles, which is where the French court had been. It moves to Paris, and they're given a room to deliberate, and that room is rectangular. And the architect finds that the only way he can accommodate everybody is to create these two sets of long flanking rows, one on the left of the presiding chair, one on the right. And all the people who want to abolish the monarchy sit on the left of the presiding officer. All the people who want to preserve the monarchy sit on the right. And believe it or not, it is from that architectural happenstance that for 250 years we talk about left wing and right wing, left of center, right of center. And so, of course, as you say, it originates in preservation of monarchy. In the 20th century, it really became all about economics. Left-wing meant you wanted state intervention, state regulation, taxation, redistribution. Right-wing meant you want less taxes, smaller government, less intervention. Now, it's once more morphing, and it fundamentally means, you know, where you sit on these cultural wars. Tony Blair puts it very nicely. He says, we're moving from left versus right to open versus closed. You know, in other words, there's a group of people who see all these changes, economic, technological, trade, diversity, emancipation of women, and they view this as a big, fascinating, open world in which they want to participate. And there's another group of people who look at all this and they say, we want to close it down. We want protectionism, we want barriers to trade, we want restraints on technology, and we want women to play a more traditional role. And so it's open versus closed in a sense that is replacing the economic arguments of left and right.
We got this email from Peter who says, I would like to know how anti-immigrant rhetoric, like statements by Trump and Orban, affect Fareed Zakaria. I personally am offended by these anti-immigrant statements, though I am a white U.S. citizen. And we should note, Fareed, you were born in India and grew up there. You moved to the U.S. to attend Yale University and say you fell in love with the United States. But to Peter's question, how are you affected?
It's a very interesting question, and I thank Peter for asking it. I've had a completely charmed existence in the United States. I came here on a scholarship from India. I, as far as I can tell, never experienced any kind of anti-immigrant rhetoric, behavior. I found Americans incredibly warm, welcoming, helped me along. You know, it's tough when you come to a new country. I didn't know a soul. I didn't have any money. And I've found that people have been incredibly generous and supportive. There were two moments at which I experienced some kind of backlash. One was after 9/11, and there was a surge of kind of, because I'm not just from India, I'm an Indian Muslim, so there was a surge of anti-Islamic rhetoric. But there was also more anti-immigrant in general. I mean, it's, you know, sadly, Americans are so often so ignorant about other places that if you remember, the first two people to be killed after 9/11 were two Sikhs, mm-hmm. Sikh Indians from the South. And, you know, Sikhs are a kind of a variation of Hinduism. They have nothing to do with Islam or Islamic fundamentalism. They just happen to wear turbans and have beards, which is what made them targets, I suppose. But that sort of faded after a while. There was, you know, there was some of it. The biggest uptick that took place was when Trump was running in 2015, and he started to use this very nasty rhetoric about immigrants and about Islam and all that kind of thing. So the way I'm tracking this is mostly my social media feed. Where would I get the most hostile comments, the most nasty stuff? And it really got quite high. And I got phone calls at my house. Somehow they found my number. And my two daughters at the time were quite young, you know, in their 9 and 13, I think, or 14. And these people would start calling, and they would pick up the phone, and these people would, you know, abuse me on the phone and say all this kind of nasty stuff. And so that was a very, very... That was an unnerving period. And then it subsided. And I would say this time around, what's interesting is the sides are so locked in that, you know, I barely ever hear from somebody who's that fanatically pro-Trump. Mm-hmm. But it's a good example of, I think, the point I imagine Peter is getting at, which is leadership matters a lot. You know, we all have dark sides to our soul. We all have angry parts of our personality. And what keeps them in check, I think, is leadership, is what you are given permission to say and what you are quietly admonished. You know what? You may be thinking this, but it's not the right thing to say. We live in an open, democratic, pluralistic society. You know, let's live and let live. Let's be tolerant. You're either getting that message or you're getting the message, no, vent your spleen. Say every dark thing that comes into your head. You know, God knows Trump does. And so it's in a way giving license for a lot of stuff that may be momentary passions of people, spasms of people, but they're often kept in check. That's one of the challenges of civilization and living in an open pluralistic society is understanding that, you know, you may have the right to say everything, anything and everything you want, but should you?
Hmm. We got this email from Ted who says, people revolt or flee due to economic realities more so than for class, religious, or personal philosophical reasons. Yes, we are in revolutionary times, but the world has always been. Fareed, when you look at the state of the world right now, and after this deep examination of the historical record, are you feeling optimistic, pessimistic, something else?
I'll take something else for the moment, mm-hmm. I think. You know, the point that the email makes is a very interesting one, and it's a place I started with when thinking about this topic, which is that, you know, it's the economic dislocation that is causing people the greatest degree of kind of anxiety, and that the rest of it is a follow-on. But there are two things that have happened that have kind of made me wonder whether that's true. One is that countries in Northern Europe that have not had as much dislocation still have right-wing populism. So there's something else going on. Sweden, which has had no particular rise in inequality, has a very big state that looks after people, a big, you know, welfare system, has now, as its second largest party, a party that traces its lineage back to the 1930s and to the, you know, actual fascist parties. Holland has a virulently anti-immigrant right-wing party. And even the United States, you know, and I know it's fashionable to say that the U.S. economy has hollowed out the middle class and such. It's really not true when you look at, I mean, just look at it comparatively and put it in simple terms. In 2008, the Eurozone economy and the U.S. economy were the same size. U.S. today is twice the size of the Eurozone economy. If Great Britain were to become the 51st state of the United States, it would be the 51st poorest state in the United States. The average income of a person in Britain is lower than that of Mississippi, which is the poorest state in America. We have done pretty well economically. There are some areas, of course, that have lagged behind. But the real thing that happened is we have had enormous amount of displacement, disruption, and change. And so imagine a steel town where the steel company factory goes away. It's not that those people, the data shows these people do get jobs and they make, you know, decent money. What changes is their whole life has been upended. There was the bowling league attached to the steel factory that goes away. There was the hardware store where they all met, but that's now gone because of Home Depot. There were other stores that people used to go to, and those are gone because of Amazon. There was the movie theater that they'd all go to. Well, that's gone because of Netflix. You know, people don't go to church anymore as much because there was, again, those things that binded people together as communities have gone. So people are atomized, displaced, lonely, anxious about all this change. And into that void come people like Trump, saying it's all because of foreigners. What was Trump's basic message when he ran in 2016? It was, the Mexicans are taking away your factory. The Mexicans are taking your jobs. The Chinese are taking your factories. The Muslims are trying to kill you. I'll beat them all up and you'll be great again. That's the message that resonated. It wasn't about economics. And so it's this cultural anxiety, this cultural backlash to change that we have to grapple with. And that's why, you know, Biden is spending all this money on rural parts of the country, on jobs that don't require college education. Well, my prediction is none of those guys are going to switch from Trump to Biden. That's not what's motivating them. And so, you know, that's why I've tried to write a book that got at this idea of, you know, a cultural and psychological backlash that's taking place to change, not just an economic one.
I can imagine someone listening right now feeling quite overwhelmed by the current state of the U.S. and the world. And hearing you say that, you know, look, it's not the economy, it's the way people think about themselves and their place in this country. And that doesn't feel like something any individual has any power over. I don't have power over your experience of the country. So what would you say to people who are feeling quite discouraged in this moment, or just as if they are at the whim of politicians or just the winds of history?
I understand exactly what you're saying. It seems a very broad, amorphous, you know, intangible kind of wave that we're struggling against. I would say two things. One, you know, we have been here before. We have gone through these periods before. If you think about, you know, 50 years ago, I remember Nikki Haley once tweeted, wasn't life simpler when you were growing up? And I was thinking to myself, you know, what is she talking about when you think about, like, take the 1970s, you know, the Vietnam War and all the protests are going on. Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy have just been assassinated. There are riots in 100 American cities. You had economic stagflation with high inflation, low unemployment. Watergate, where the president of the United States was caught basically engaging in criminal activity. we have such a kind of rosy-colored memory of what things were like. And, you know, we got through that, we'll get through this. And the second is, look, there is something you can do. There really is, you know, I try not to be partisan, but there is a real choice in this election. You have, on the one hand, the only president in American history who tried to contest the peaceful transfer of power. This never happened before. And who convinced a majority of House Republicans inside that Capitol that day, January 6th, to vote against the peaceful transfer of power, to decertify an election that every state, all 50 states certified, and about 50 court cases looked at and determined was free and fair. And on the other side, you have a regular American politician who upholds the norms and values of liberal democracy. And that's a consequential choice as to where we will go as a country.
That's Fareed Zakaria. He's host of CNN's international affairs show, GPS. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, and his new book out this week is Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present. Fareed, thank you for speaking with us.
It's such a pleasure.
Today's producer was Anna Casey. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.